Okay, so we try to trace certain characteristic features of Rav Lichtenstein through some of the ideas on Pesach that he delivered in some of his sikhot. Remember, the Shiva wasn't in session on Pesach, so these are sikhot which typically were delivered during the Parshios, Shmos Ve'erabel V'Shalach, discussing, his Parshios discussed Pesach-related themes. Two nights ago, we saw how he took the pasuk in Ve'eschana Kor HaBarzel, which described Egypt in a formative sense. It wasn't just a penalty or an exile to serve our sentence, but it forged certain aspects of national identity, in particular, the moral underpinnings of what it means to be a Jew, Jewish identity, Jewish consciousness. Last night, we discussed time management, time experience, beginning the counting scheme from the month that launches history, not the month that launches nature. And human beings live in two different continuums, in two different frameworks. We live in nature, we live in history. We're authors in a creative sense of history, whereas we're passive, bounded human beings sharing our natural landscape with the rest of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creation. Rav Lichtenstein quoted a Ramban about the word Nisayon. Very famous question. Why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu challenge people? So Ramban's very famous response is that the function of a Nisayon is to elucidate or to amplify certain latent potentials. So we all know we have potential, but sometimes they remain untapped or we're unaware of them, we're not conscious of them, we can implement them easily. So the purpose of a Nisayon is to elucidate them. So the Ramban writes, line number 4, source number 1, L'otzi adaver min ha'koach al'apol, li'os lo schar ma'ise tov, lo schar leiv tov. Namely, we may have certain latent potentials in our consciousness and our identities, but a Nisayon has the capacity to draw them, to elucidate them. And that's why he quotes the pasuk in Tehillim, Hashem tzadik yibchan. Hashem doesn't pose a challenge to a person that can't meet it. Essentially, every challenge reflects the person's capacity. Rav Lichtenstein felt that in addition to this Ramban's purpose, a Nisayon doesn't just allow latent potential to emerge, it also increases and augments potential. The very fact of obeying HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that process is formative, and that increases and augments the level of obedience. Once you obey, you're able to obey further. So the purpose of the Nisayon is not just to expand or amplify a latent potential, but also to increase the potential for obedience. Because one level of Avodas Hashem, mitzvah bereres mitzvah, Avodas Hashem, bereres Avodas Hashem. So the Ramban had one idea for a Nisayon. Rav Lichtenstein suggested a different idea. And I alluded to this earlier, I think on Sunday, when we discussed this last MS. Should we be searching for meaning in mitzvahs? What's the symbolism? What's the purpose? What's the reason? Should there be a time behind every mitzvah? Or should mitzvahs be taken on their own as acts of obedience? This is a major question in the medieval period. The challenge to the Ramban, who tried to tag as many mitzvahs as he could with reasons. There were great dangers associated with that tagging process. But one of the oppositions was based on mitzvah should be ke'eved lifnei rabo, ke'eved hamajaridus rabo, lo manas l'kavo pras. So the moment that I try to identify a human-based reason for a mitzvah, I may be humanizing the mitzvah rather than tackling it as a pure act of obedience. And Rav Lichtenstein felt that the two obviously complement, and we know in our lives they complement. Reasons are important motivations for mitzvahs, but at the baseline of the mitzvah has to be that sense of submitting our will and submitting our obedience. We have the freedom to disobey, and we submit that freedom to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I just want to read to you a quote that Rav Lichtenstein cited from Dostoevsky. Now, this is not a literal translation, because he gave a sikhot in Hebrew, and then there were teams of people, maybe even some people in this room, who sat Masei Shabbos and tried to recreate those sikhot afterwards. There's a good sikhot given on Shabbos. In the 80s, I was part of that team, so I was sitting there Masei Shabbos with a group of people. And I take great pleasure when someone comes and says, I read a Sikha of Rav Lichtenstein from 1984. I spent my Saturday night well. It was a good decision. I could have seen Rambo 4, and instead I went out summarize Rav Lichtenstein's article and catch Rambo 4 on YouTube. But now thousands of people are getting to appreciate his Torah. And interestingly enough, a lot of conversations, did Rav Lichtenstein believe in Torah Mada? Did he not believe in Torah Mada? How did he stack up against Rav Soloveitchik? I'm going to say a statement now just for effect, just for dramatic effect. I don't think Rav Lichtenstein believed in Torah Mada, and that's obviously a very dramatic statement. For Rav Soloveitchik, it was about seeing three different worlds colliding, synthesis, antithesis, or thesis, antithesis, synthesis, Hezbollah of math, and philosophy, and theology, crisis theology, stack up with the world of religion and Judaism, what happens when the two merge. Rav Lichtenstein had a combination of two factors. Number one, he obviously was a very sincere and pious Ovin Hashem, and he was a humanist. He really believed in humanity. So if he confronted other human beings, Jew or Gentile, that had very deep, profound ideas that they articulated about religion, he was interested in reading them. So he read them to make himself more devout. And he felt that Milton could capture the struggle of a blind man in ways that Chazal didn't have time for. And he felt that, so he's very, I never heard him say the following word, which to me is very, very, very reflective. And in my entire life, I mean, it could be, I'm forgetting, I never heard him use a word which I typically hear other people use. Typically, when a person is giving a Devar Torah, then they quote Shakespeare, Wordsworth, or let's say Lahavdil. They try to create a boundary between Kodesh and Chol. He never, ever used that word. Because I don't think he ever saw himself as veering outside of Kodesh. You have to establish a boundary. If you exit that territory, you move to another territory, moving out of Mikdash, moving into Chol, Lahavdil. I think he saw himself as remaining solidly within the world of Kedusha, but that world of Kedusha could be enhanced and enriched by people who operated outside of the orbit of Judaism, because they were devout people, and he just was a lover of mankind in the truest sense. He was a humanist and a lover of people, he was kind to people. So when he called for Dostoevsky, it wasn't a moment that we all clicked and said, oh, here's Torah Magu on display. He just felt that Dostoevsky could add to the conversation. Remember one Friday night in Yeshiva, actually he was discussing Spiritus. And the first three rows of people were all head nodding, sleeping. And all of a sudden, in the middle of his discussion of Chet Adam Harishon, he had this loud shriek. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together. 40 heads of the front two rows shot up. Then he just quoted Mother Goose. Evidently, it's not a Mother Goose rhyme, but it's a metaphor for the fall of man and the irrecoverability of man's dramatic descent into a fallen state. All the king's horses and all the king's men. Of course, after the Sikha, all the Israelis lined up and asked their Mizah Humpty Dumpty Rishon, wasn't it with Sefri Rav? But to me, that was also very reflective. He wasn't quoting major works and major ideas if Mother Goose was appropriate for the setting. He quoted Mother Goose, he quoted Alice in Wonderland. Obviously, his quotes tended to, they trended towards high-minded ideas written by high-minded authors, but he wasn't above quoting sports figures because he just was trying to establish a universalizing, broadening effect to the religious values to convince us that these were deeply ingrained in human experience and, of course, in Jewish experience. So this is a quote of Dostoevsky, but it's a rough quote because it's quoted by the people who summarized this particular share. Dostoevsky, in discussing the difference between slavery and freedom, points out that the slave lives a life of security. We think about that as a prison inmate. True, he works hard, but in exchange for this, he receives the security of knowing where his next meal will come from. And to a large extent, he is freed of the moral conflicts attendant upon free choice. Freedom burdens us with moral conflicts. The free man, on the other hand, is faced with much loftier challenge. Not only must he fend for himself, he must choose who he will obey. Western civilization, this is not what Wittgenstein, obviously, is locked now in a struggle with ISIS, Islamic fundamentalism. And it's obviously not just a struggle of terror and bombs and military might, it's a struggle of ideas. And you can't defeat ideas with weapons. You have to defeat an idea with a more compelling idea. So their idea is fanatic Islamic fundamentalism. What's Western civilization's idea? Freedom? Freedom can't be an idea. Freedom's a means. Freedom's a means to ensure human resources, to protect society and civil rights. But what are we fighting for? I say, well, no, in Israel, we're fighting. What's Western civilization fighting for? iPhone 7? The next Samsung display phone, until Western civilization locates its idea, it will not defeat the idea of Islamic fundamentalism because we can't stand for freedom. Freedom, to a degree, has intoxicated humanity because of such a powerful revolution, 18th century, 19th century, after so many centuries of feudalism and oppression. So it captured, hypnotized humanity. But there's something beyond freedom. And during the Chag of Chayyim Seinu, Baruch Hashem, we know that Eretz Yisrael, the top of our pyramid is not freedom. We enjoy freedom, we enjoy democracy, we're proud of democracy, we live for something larger than freedom, larger than liberty. So a free man has a challenge, has a choice to make. You're interested to read this British philosopher, there's some Brits in the audience, Isaiah Berlin, who wrote an article, or a series of essays called Four Essays of Freedom, Four Types of Freedom, right around World War II, when man was trying to process his hard-fought and hard-earned freedom. So for Rav Lichtenstein, there was the the process of nisayon builds obedience. And just getting back very quickly, it's taking a little longer than I thought. This is how we saw the whole Mara exercise. We're about to read Shvi'i Shel Pesach. I'm segueing to Shvi'i Shel Pesach. And Mara, we were delivering mitzvahs. Which mitzvahs were delivered? According to the Ramban, actually, these were mitzvahs that were necessary technically for those couple of weeks just to transition them towards Har Sinai. Whatever laws and instructions were necessary, possibly Shabbos, talking about Shabbos and Mitzvah Shem Friday night, that first Shabbos in Mara, the second Shabbos in Alosh, talking about some of the elements of Shabbos which were added. But for Rashi, as you're well familiar with, there were three mitzvahs, three exhibition mitzvahs, three trial mitzvahs, Shabbos, Paraduma, and Dina. It's a very famous question. Shabbos makes sense. It's rational. It's fundamental. It's constitutional. It's baseline. Dinim, civil rights, judiciary responsibilities. Paraduma, no one was Tameh. There was no Tumah. There was no Mishkan. There was no Paraduma. The answer is it's the quintessential Chok. It's the quintessential irrational mitzvah. And part of religious orientation and training is the ability to submit to a mystery. Not just to submit to a mitzvah of meaning and symbolism, but the ability to submit simply because the Kadosh Baruch Hu mandates it. And this became the launching pad for Rabbi Lichtenstein to discuss with us how we articulate our religion. Now, this is me speaking now, but as a student of Rabbi Lichtenstein, what I received from Rabbi Lichtenstein, I think in the modern era, we tend to articulate religion in terms which accommodate the modern discourse and feature human beings at the center. So if I asked you for 5 to 6 words that you would use to convince someone about religion, you'd say meaning, value, content, ennobling, enriching, purpose. What about Avodas Hashem? When we articulate religion in those terms, we essentially are interested in religion because it enhances us. It's anthropocentric. What about articulating religion as not convenience, but service? Not enrichment, but submission? Not enhancing who we are, but simply breaking human will? As Rabbi Lichtenstein always quoted to us, this is a quote I'll never forget, religion is about having shoulders broad enough to bear the weight of religion without being crushed by the weight of religion. But religion is a weight. How do we carry that weight? So a couple of years before he was Nifter, they asked, there was a very interesting, I think it was Rav Sabato in his famous book, M'bakshei Panecha, which is really the book I'd recommend to everyone as a starter for a book if you want to expose to him. It's now been translated into English. Rav Chaim Sabato interviewed Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who provided short little blurbs in response to these books. I can't imagine a more dynamic duo than Rav Sabato interviewing Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And now that it's in English, you may lose the floral language of Sabato, but certainly the English captures the idea. And he asked it, I think, in this sefer, what do you want inscribed on your tombstone? And you think something very dramatic, very intense, reflective of a god of this stature. And Rav Aaron said he wanted 2 words, and those are the words that are inscribed on his kever, Eved Hashem. Nothing bombastic, nothing triumphant, nothing floral, or simply Eved Hashem. And to me, that was always, and people have commented on this, not just myself, obviously, he was so sophisticated. He was so refined. He was so elegant. He walked into a room. The room became radiant. You knew there was one person in the room around whom the entire room pivoted. He was that smart. He was that dignified. He was almost an Uberman. But he wore his Avodas Hashem as an Eved Hashem so clearly to us. And he prevented us from making this very facile dichotomy that many people make between the smart people and the firm people. Okay, that person says to Helen and screams davening and chuckles and very devout and pious, but I'm a smart person. I went to college. I went to university. I went to graduate school. I knew Shakespeare. I articulate religion in different terminology. Well, he didn't allow us the bifurcation, because he was that person who went to graduate school, who read all the great works, who was a practitioner of Brisker there. There's a person who, and I'm sure I'll elicit a lot of smiles, remember his Birchas Hatorah? His Birchas Hatorah penetrated the heavens. He didn't get up and make a Birchas Hatorah. He screamed it at the top of his lungs in ways that modern men find uncomfortable. We don't scream at each other. If I get up and make a Birchas Hatorah that loud, it'd be off. It'd be rude, because I'm invading your space by screaming out as much kibbutz as I can in a private, quiet manner. Rav Lichtenstein would shout his Kaddish, his Birchas Hatorah. We knew it was a Tannis when he shouted that word, Dir Shu. In particular, in davening, we always saw an Eved Hashem, and that towered above all of his other traits, and it didn't allow us, those who read him carefully, to acquit themselves from trying to form and develop themselves into an obedient Eved Hashem. Because however we were to acquit ourselves, oh, I'm too smart for that, I'm too developed, I'm too refined for that, it didn't work because he had already set that model. So here he discussed Avodas Hashem and obedience, and not trying to link mitzvahs to human-based or human-yielding experiences, rather submission per se, obedience per se.
Shabbat, you're doing a wonderful job of, you know.
I'm sitting thinking, you just got it. I remember when we learned, I'm sure you did, Bill. This is, you should write this up. Take these, write them up. You got it. I mean, you know, I remember once standing at I was at a Fremont, you know, the Fremont.
So his grandmother, his grandmother.